On This Week in Enterprise Tech, is USB killing your Wi-Fi? The DHS can seize your stuff, UPnP is getting out of control, and security, security, security. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 29, recorded February 11th, 2013. The Inevitable Headache. This episode of Twyatt is brought to you by Hover.com. Hover is the reliable domain name registration and management service that's simple, honest, and easy to use. For exceptional customer support and 10% off your new domain name, go to hover.com/enterprise and enter offer code ENTERPRISE. And by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why I love my cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup costs on RingCentral is $20 per month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasier, the Digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. And I'm joined by an absolutely fantastic Four Musketeers-type panel, starting with Mr. Brian Chi from the hollowed-out volcano in Hawaii. Brian, how are things for the geek in paradise?
I'm doing fine, other than I've got this little spot on my chin from some molten pizza.
Molten pizza. Well, we may have to talk about that. I'm not exactly sure what a molten pizza injury is or if insurance covers it, but it sounds interesting. Over to the East Coast, where Mr. Curtis Franklin is, bringing in our audience from Enterprise Efficiency. Curtis, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Padre. Here on the East Coast, it's pleasant, warm, and humid. Spent last week out in the desert in Phoenix, and it's nice to be back in the swamp.
Back in the swamp. Good show title if I ever heard one. Now, the man who acts as that little devil that sits on my shoulder and screams jokes at me, Mr. Oliver Rist. Oliver, how are you doing, and where are you today?
I'm still in sunny/rainy Seattle, Washington, as I look out the window here, and I'm a little surprised to hear that the Catholic Church has revised its definition of Satan to be a comedian. But I'll take your word for it, since you are the Jesuit.
Yes, I am the Jesuit, and I have the hotline to the Pope.
That's right.
Well, we're not going to talk about that story. But you know, I tell you what we are going to talk about. We're going to talk about how USB 3.0 can disrupt Wi-Fi. That's right. We've got a story here out of the Mac Observer that is discussing a long-running issue with certain Mac products where if you plug in a USB 3 device, a hard drive, a flash drive, that you can actually lose your connectivity to a 2.4 gigahertz Wi-Fi access point. Now, a couple of engineers have taken a spectrum analyzer to this and basically figured out that at certain times, certain intervals, if your equipment is not designed properly, USB 3.0 signaling can generate 2.4 gigahertz interference, which basically blots out any attempt to connect to a wireless access point in that frequency range. Now, this strikes me as just something that's kind of sad, funny on so many levels. This is something that should be tested for. This is something that should have been designed out of the product. This is something that they should have figured out when they dropped the spec for USB 3.0. But, Chibert, I want to start with you. How common is it to have technologies like this, two very established technologies, USB and Wi-Fi, now competing for a specific piece of spectrum?
Well, you have a microwave, don't you? That uses the exact same space as 2.4 gigahertz, 802.11b and g. So the other things that a lot of people don't realize is those orange lights that you have in playgrounds and so forth, those emit at 2.5 gigahertz also. So it's all about signal-to-noise ratio. If the noise is too high and you can't tell the signal from the noise, then you don't have data transmission.
Right, right. Now, Curtis, I want to throw this over to you. This is not the first time that we've had two technologies that use the same pieces of spectrum in their signaling. And actually, this is not a new problem. I think what's unique to this is that you have two very high profile technologies that now seem to not want to play together. Now, it should be pointed out that this problem only exists if the headers are put right next to each other. For example, if you take the Wi-Fi antenna and you stick it on the board right next to the header for USB 3.0. It's not as if having a USB 3.0 hard drive in the same room as an iPad is going to kill the iPad. So there have to be some very specific engineering requirements for this inference to take place. But my question to you is, as Chibert mentioned, this is something that we see a lot in technology. But should it have been something that was caught way earlier on in the technical specification revisions?
Well, I don't know that it should have been caught in the technical spec revisions. I think it certainly should have been caught in the design revisions for the particular products that are having the problem. This is the sort of thing that simple usability and basic product testing should have been able to handle. As you correctly point out, back in the days of desktop computers, this wasn't an issue at all because you had sufficient spacing and, frankly, you had good enough RF shielding in most of those machines that it didn't become a problem. It's only now that we're really pushing the limit on packaging and spacing that we're finding all kinds of interactions that were there potentially all along, but now we're seeing them happen because the components are so close to one another.
Right. Oliver, let me throw this to you because it does seem that Curtis is right on the money here. And that is, as we've gotten into smaller and smaller packaging, problems that didn't exist, like having an antenna sitting right on top of a header port for input-output, are going to become much more commonplace. We have had signal interactions before with inside an electronics case. In fact, we had an episode of Twiet not too long ago where we talked about the black magic of RF and how a lot about RF is still not quite understood, how signals interact within a confined structure, within a case. But as products shrink and as we try to jam more and more components into these small enclosures, this is a problem that's going to expand, is it not?
Well, first of all, what's USB again? just kidding. No, I don't. I think Curtis is on the money. I don't think it has to. I think if a product is tested properly, then no, you shouldn't see it. Of course, in real life, no, they're not going to test a product properly because it's too expensive. So yes, in the real world, yeah, I expect to see more problems like that. But I think again, Microsoft's the model here screwed up in Rev 1, fix it in Rev 2. So
right,
just you know.
So I guess the take home here is just don't buy Rev 1 hardware.
Bingo. There. Don't buy Rev 1 anything.
Don't buy Rev 1 anything. Words to live by. Let's get on to a bit more serious news, and that is the Department of Homeland Security has okayed the suspicionless seizure of electronic devices at the U.S. border. Now, this comes from the watchdog group of the DHS. It was an organization that was established along with the DHS to go over some of the very rapidly changing privacy concerns that were going to take place as the DHS tried to do its job. The whole idea was, well, look, every time we have a new piece of technology, every time we have a new technique for smuggling something into the country, we can't make a brand new law. So we're going to have a watchdog group that will sort of act as the conscience of the DHS. Well, this watchdog group has now stated that, well, basically the DHS can seize anything at any time with no provocation, with no warning, with no justification, really. It stems off of a case they had of a man coming back into the United States with his U.S. passport. The DHS pulled his laptop out, asked him to enter in his password, which he did. They found some pictures of some Hezbollah at a rally. And he explained that he was a doctoral student and he was trying to do some research. Well, they seized his equipment and they didn't give it back to him until his lawyer 2 weeks later basically said, look, is there a reason why you're holding on to his equipment and on to his research? This is, well, I mean, it's way past the slippery slope. This is near the bottom of the slippery slope where the government is now saying, if you bring it back into the country, it's fair game for us to take. We don't even have to explain why. Oliver, let me give this to you first. Let me let you vent your anger. What do you think about this? Is there anything you can do to fight this? Is this completely ridiculous? Is this the height of Big Brother?
I won't say at the height of Big Brother, but yes, it does piss me off. It's just yet another example of our country being run on fear with absolutely no consideration for any kind of research or expertise, right? I mean, DHS, honestly, those guys are not going to know anything about what's supposedly a suspicious piece of hardware versus what's a non-suspicious piece of hardware. So basically, they can just take laptops, I guess, that they want to sell on eBay later or something. It bugs the hell out of me.
Right. Curtis, let me go over to you, because something Oliver said was interesting, and that is DHS doesn't know the difference between suspicious hardware versus non-suspicious hardware. But then again, really none of us do, right? I mean, how can you tell the difference between a flash drive that holds state secrets and a flash drive that holds my kid's birthday pictures? To put it more into a level that we should be dealing with here, if you have an exec who, say, is traveling to China to negotiate a business deal with a factory, when he comes back, should he have to worry about anything that's on his computer that could possibly divulge trade secrets about his organization? If DHS can just seize it, it's basically that he's surrendering his right and his company's right to privacy every time he comes past our border.
Well, that's in fact what the DHS is saying, that essentially the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply if you're crossing the border. And on the one hand, I'm confident that we're going to have a string of lawsuits on this any day now. On the other hand, if I were doing a lot more international travel on business, I would take one of two approaches. One is to Federal Express my hardware back and forth. When you get ready to leave, drop it in a FedEx box. Chances are that it will be waiting for you, or it will be at your office shortly after you arrive. The other is to use nothing but either a Chromebook where everything is done in the cloud, or do everything via a virtual desktop where no data resides on your laptop at all. If the only thing on your laptop is an operating system with no locally stored files.
Okay, well, I'm sure Curtis will be coming back in just a bit. But let's continue with that. Chibert, I want to throw over to you, because what Curtis said, and actually what several people in the chat room are saying, from Virgil and Arbiter and so on and so forth, is that, well, hasn't the DHS ever heard of the internet? Curtis mentioned it when he talked about executives doing everything in a virtual desktop. And there's this idea of, well, just don't have it on your local device. But we've already covered stories about how the U.S. government is also trying to reach into the cloud in any number of ways, saying that if it's in the cloud, we have the ability to search through it. If it's in the cloud, it's not really yours. If it's in the cloud, we can seize servers without having to get warrants for your data. So is there really an alternative? It's sort of, well, if I put it in the cloud, the government can look at it. If I carry it on my person, the government can look at it. What are the other options?
Actually, I'm going to tell a story about a software engineer that I know pretty well. And they would have to go to foreign countries, work on, different projects, and sometimes work on special code. Now, the trick is, this is intellectual property of the corporation. Their solution was that remotely they will make the changes, and they will go and check those changes into the revision system. Then they will purposely scrub their laptops. They will actually go and do a military wipe on the hard drive and travel with a blank hard drive back to the U.S. Because they don't trust the U.S. government enough not to accidentally release proprietary code. A little less aggressive is people that are doing whole disk encryption. And they're basically of the opinion that if the DHS wants to see it, they're going to have a warrant, and then they'll be happy to decrypt the hard drive. But they're going to force them to do a warrant and force the lawyers to get involved to protect that corporate information intellectual property.
FF00005 and Joel H in the chat room have both said the same thing, and that is, well, why wouldn't I just do a VPN into a private cloud? Why wouldn't I VPN back into, say, my corporate network and just work off of that? Oliver, I want to throw back to you. Chibert's suggestion seems to be to the super, super paranoid, the super, super extreme. Would a solution like VPNing back into a private cloud be more acceptable? Let me throw up a hypothetical situation here. Let's say the three of you are running your own small business with a group of employees who have to travel internationally. What would your policy be for how they access the corporate data and the corporate network? Oliver, let's start with you.
Yes, remote access would totally be the way that I'd go. I'd use a virtual desktop. I'd use virtual resources, use the cloud. I mean, hell, that's kind of what it's there for. Storing data locally ought to be disabled. I know, you know, practically that it can't be, but that would be my key law, right? Nothing local, everything cloud, especially if it's just, you know, code work. Those usually aren't very heavy files.
Yeah. Curtis, on to you. Nothing local, everything in the cloud. What's your suggestion?
I absolutely think that everything in the cloud is the right way to go. I also think this is a wonderful argument in favor of virtual desktops. Keep everything back on central servers and travel with just as skinny a mobile device as you can get away with. If you can travel across the border with no data at all on that system, then I think you're winning the game.
Hubert, I want to give you the last word on this because you seem to have the ultra paranoid solution. Is that enough? I mean, is it enough to say, look, I'm not going to have any data local, I'm going to access everything remotely, or would you go with the military wipe solutions?
Actually, if I was running a corporation, I would probably go with as much as possible remote desktop, you know, virtual desktops. But there's always going to be some data that you absolutely have to have. So I actually have a Corsair encrypted USB drive, and that holds images. It holds my medical information, it holds my credit card information and things like that. And we're going to be talking about another solution a little later in the show on how I handle that information. But the problem is you really do have to have a little bit on your local machine. I think the little bit on that local machine should be encrypted.
Good. All right. This is definitely not a conversation that's over, but it's a conversation we're going to pass through because we're going to get back to it later in the episode. It's going to be a dynamite episode, ladies and gentlemen. But before we get to that, I want to take some time to talk about a brand new sponsor to the show, and that's Hover, hover.com. Are you looking for a reliable, honest domain name registration and management service that is easy to use? If so, you got to check out Hover. Now, Hover makes it easy because Hover believes in two core concepts. The first is that everyone should be able to take control of their online identity with their own domain name, and they make it easy for you to do so. Hover also tries to take all the hassle out of owning and managing domain names with smart, easy-to-use, friction-free, and powerful domain name management tools. Now, Hover is a different kind of domain name registration company because they try to keep it real. They're all about honesty. Hover doesn't believe in heavy-handed upselling or aggressive cross-selling. Hover doesn't believe in hiding functionality or requiring extra payments for things that should be included with your domain name management. Things like Whois privacy, subdomains, and URL forwarding are all included in your plan. Hover also keeps it real. They only offer you services that enhance the domain name experience. They'll only ever partner with companies that they believe offer their customers value and whose customer-first values mirrors their own. Hover Email also makes it easy and affordable to create a memorable email address and eschew the impersonal free webmail email services that seem so popular around the web. Hover offers you choices. They have 23 top-level domains, including .com, .net, .org, as well as TV, .pro, .mobi, and .biz. They also offer you some of the most popular country code TLDs like .ca, .asia, .us, and .uk. Finally, Hover is here for the long haul. They offer excellent online help, support documentation and tutorials, covering everything from moving domain names to Hover, setting up your redirects and domain forwards, pointing DNS to the most popular web hosting services, and much, much more. Hover also offers a no-hold, no-wait, and no-transfer phone policy. You call 866-731-6556, Monday to Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., and you'll be speaking to a live person who is empowered and eager to help you. Hover is also a part of TwoCows, a company that has been around since 1994 and that is one of the largest domain name registrars in the world. So don't wait. If you need domain name registration service and management, visit Hover today at hover.com/enterprise. To register your domain name, use our offer code ENTERPRISE and get 10% off. That's hover.com/enterprise and the offer code ENTERPRISE. We thank Hover for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, we need to sort of back up a bit because we glossed over a huge story last week, and I received a lot of tweets, a lot of emails, and one very serious-looking actual snail mail letter, which is weird. I haven't received one of those in a long time, that basically asked me to re-explain the UPnP vulnerability that was found last week. So let me gloss over the story a little bit, and then let's dive into exactly what it means for you. H.D. Moore, the man of Metasploit fame, the man who wrote the framework for the very first time, completed a 5.5-month scan of all the publicly reachable space on the internet. So the IPv4 address range, he went through all of it about once a week with enough computing power to scan each and every single IP address. At the end of that scan, what he found was that there are about 81 million devices that have the UPnP port service open on the WAN side. That is port 1900. Now, UPnP is a service that was created to allow small and home routers to easily reconfigure themselves to allow you to use, say, your Xbox. So, for example, when you have an Xbox or when you have, let's say, a Skype phone, it needs to poke holes in the firewall so that you can have incoming connections. Most of our firewalls are designed so that you can have all the outgoing connections you want, but anything coming in, well, that's typically restricted unless it's been open, unless you've opened that port. UPnP let the services like Skype or like Xbox actually reconfigure the firewall on the fly to open those services and let you use your gaming system, let you use the utilities that you want to use in a very easy fashion. Now, here's the problem. UPnP is a little bit of a security kludge because it doesn't require a password. Any device on the inside of your network can talk to the router and say, reconfigure yourself so that it has these open ports. Well, if you have a rogue device on the inside of your network, it could say, open up all the ports to all the devices, and suddenly you're messed up. But that's not what the story is about. The story is about the fact that that service on 81 million devices has been open to the outside world. So devices outside of your network can now talk to your router and say, I would like you to open up port so-and-so to the device, the computer, the laptop, the iPad at IP address 192.168.0.10. And suddenly that device looks like it's on the internet, and it can be attacked if it's got any open ports. It can be enumerated. It can be compromised in any number of ways. So with this vulnerability, what has basically happened is that people who have these routers that are affected, and you got to remember it's typically three different dev kits for UPnP that have this vulnerability. If they're not properly patched, if they're not updated, you can expose what's called the SOAP interface, which will allow people to compromise the router, enumerate it, find out exactly what it is, and then execute code on that router, gaining access to your entire network. It's actually incredibly, incredibly scary. Let me throw it over to our expert panel. Chibert, I thought that we had discussed it enough. Evidently, we had not stressed enough exactly how scary this vulnerability is. What does this mean, UPnP on the WAN side, to a typical home user who maybe bought a $20 router from Fry's Electronics?
Actually, the scary one is when I was sitting in front of my cousin's house and decided I wanted to go and get some Wi-Fi because she was late, and I was sitting there and goes, so I started scanning the neighborhood, and I went and dug around and found out her neighbor's router was open. Not only that, I was able to go and start up a configuration and actually reconfigure their Wi-Fi router because it was interfering with my cousin's router. And I, you know, as I was thinking, oh, maybe I should fix this, they go, whoa, this is actually electronic breaking and entering. I better back off. But it was open on their Wi-Fi. Now, the question is, gee, if it's open on the Wi-Fi, is it also open on WAN? And through some digging while I was on my cousin's house, I found out, yes, indeed, UPnP was answering. So because cable modems, especially a lot of the residential ones, it's all one big network in your neighborhood. You can actually go and browse for other people's machines. And if UPnP is turned on, say, for a cheapy NAS box, now all of a sudden your family pictures are now exposed. You can actually browse for those and mount across someone else's cable modem. That's what's really scary.
Right. Now, I will say that, Chiebert, that story is that you allegedly...
yes, I allegedly.
Allegedly. I will also say that I know a person with decent engineering skills. We're going to call him Madre. And Madre, here in San Jose, when he was living at one of the parishes, he did somewhat of the same thing. He was finding that there was a lot of interference from the wireless access points from the houses around his house because they had set it at, you know, they thought it was... different if they set it at 2 versus 3 versus 4 versus 5 on the 2.4 gigahertz range. So he didn't want to have to break WPA encryption. Instead, he went the other way. He did a scan through his node. He found out that 4 or 5 of the routers in his neighborhood had this UPnP vulnerability. He reconfigured the routers to go to a computer on that network, owned the computer, came back in on the web interface of the cable modem slash Wi-Fi access point, and then just reconfigured the Wi-Fi so that everything lined up nice and neatly. Now, that was kind of fun. It was an adventure for Madre, but it does point out what someone could have done if they really wanted to do damage. Because they were able to reconfigure the routers, they were able to own a specific computer within that network. If that computer was then, say, used to... oh, I don't know, access financial information or email accounts, that computer would have transmitted that information back to the person who had owned it. Let me give this over to you, Curtis. There's a lot of people who are going to say, well, this is just a small to medium business problem. It's not going to affect enterprise. Enterprise routers would never have UPnP enabled on the WAN port. But there's this question of, your users, the users of an enterprise network, may have this vulnerability at home or in their small office. So should enterprise be worried about this?
Oh, I think enterprise should absolutely be worried about this. And for precisely the reason that you give, the notion of the traditional enterprise network perimeter is really very old-fashioned. Our perimeters are the entire internet now. So if something is going on in an employee's home network, it is, in effect, going on the enterprise network. So if our employees have this vulnerability, if the employee's working from home, then our enterprise network has the vulnerability. And I think this is the case when the enterprise IT shops have an obligation to educate their users, let everyone know that the problem exists, and if necessary, devote some human resources to helping their employees figure out how to strengthen their home networks so that the entire enterprise network is strengthened.
Oliver, let me bring this over to you because this seems to be a very important point, and that is, yeah, the boundaries of the enterprise network are now the internet because, well, unless we have access to it remotely, unless we have access to it wherever we're working, an enterprise network is really kind of useless. But there's that part of me that says, no, 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 no. If I'm at home or if I'm remote, my enterprise should not be able to control what I'm doing. They should not be able to configure my routers, my clients, my whatever it might be. But is that mindset dead now? I mean, should I, as a responsible internet citizen or a responsible enterprise network user, recognize that, yeah, what I do with my router, what I do with my home network is going to affect my enterprise, and therefore they need to have some say in how I use those resources?
Wow.
That's a big one. That's a big one.
Yeah, that is a big one. I suppose I should say yes. I, of course, would personally not care. I would simply disable UPnP on my side, whether they liked it or not. Of course, I did that, and certain things crashed, including Link, which was a problem. So now I've turned it back on until I figure the Link issue out. So I guess in practical sense, you'd have to wait for the IT department should send instructions. Okay, if we do turn it off, either you have to do these things, or they should send me an image that keeps my stuff working without me having to play with it. But apparently, just simply disabling UPnP on my side will cause me problems. And so from an end user perspective, that would certainly influence my decision of whether or not I was going to support my enterprise on my own or whether I would wait for them to do it.
All right. Actually, that's a huge point, and I want to bring that out to our listeners because that was one of the things that was most mentioned in the emails that I received. Let me throw this back over to you, Cheebert, and that is, it's easy for us to say, oh, look, just turn UPnP off. It should be off in the first place. You shouldn't be running it. It's insecure. It's a really good way to mess up your network. Even if you didn't have that WAN vulnerability, most of us would say, look, turn UPnP off if you want to have a modicum of security on your home network. But if you do that, if the users out there actually do turn off UPnP and they don't know how to do things like poke holes in their firewall or redirect incoming ports, then there's a lot of things that will break. Xboxes will break. The PlayStation 3 will break. Services like Skype and some of these VoIP services will just not work properly. And we can't expect the average user out there to suddenly take a crash course in how to configure his or her firewall. I mean, can we? But what's the solution here between having an automatic configuration and having a secure configuration?
Okay, so this is where I'm going to get a ton of hate mail. I am of the opinion that if you're going to be working on confidential information from home, that there ought to be a minimum requirement for firewalls. Now, instead of putting the onus of reconfiguring all this on the user, I think the IT group should take some of the responsibility. That's why all the large firewall vendors, SonicWall, WatchGuard, Checkpoint, you name it, all these guys have SMB SOHO devices. Now, what makes them really, really different from the cheapies that you can buy at Best Buy or Fry's or whatever is that they have the ability to have an encrypted link back to corporate. So since I know the SonicWall system, they have a system called GMS, and it allows you to clone firewalls very quickly, send it out to your users, and then through a secure encrypted link, remote manage it so that the help desk can actually get in, make some changes to that firewall, help the user, but not kill themselves on HR costs to support them. It's one of those nice things because a lot of people keep forgetting that when you open a hole in a firewall, if you're on a cheap firewall, it's kind of like just leaving a door in a hotel room open. Enterprise firewalls, when you open a port, they usually have deep packet inspection, which is like opening the door but putting a bouncer there to make sure that whatever goes through is actually safe. That's kind of my opinion on what should happen, you know, especially since the SMB SOHO machines aren't horribly expensive. They're a lot more expensive than the cheapies, but they're not horribly, horribly expensive, especially when you equate in the human resource costs for supporting it.
Now, before we go on, I do want to mention that Steve Gibson of Security Now, he has actually created a tool that will allow you to know whether or not you have this vulnerability. It was a little confusing last time because, let me be honest here, GRC can be a little confusing to navigate. What you want to do is you want to go to grc.com and you want to click on Shields Up. Oh, okay. And, well, you know what? Actually, it doesn't work really well on Chrome. Let me bring up another browser here. Sorry about that. So first of all, don't use Chrome. Oh, actually,
I don't.
Gibson Research seems to be kind of messed up at the moment.
Wow, you got the you picked the best ones, dude.
Steve, I hate to do this, but okay, let's find out if we can navigate. Oh my goodness. No, something borked over at GRC. You know, we're going to try it again a little bit later on when hopefully it comes back up. But grc.com is going to be the site you're going to want to go to. That's the one that actually works quite well when the server is working properly. It will do a quick scan of port 1900 on your router, and it will tell you whether or not your router is responding to UPnP requests. Curtis, I'm going to go over to you. And what about this idea that Cheebert has about saying, look, if you're going to use enterprise resources at home, someone from IT is going to come down. They're going to hand you a router and say, this is the router you're going to use at home. It's going to establish a secure tunnel back to the enterprise network. And that's the only way you're going to get in. We won't let you use anything else to access network resources remotely.
I think that for some enterprises and some users, that that's absolutely the way to go. I think another perhaps middle ground would be to have an approved list of home routers along with an approved set of policies that someone from the help desk can help a user set up, and maybe even the enterprise can do a bulk purchase on to help them get that. The thing is, you have extremes on both ends. What we're seeing more and more is that enterprise cannot afford to simply ignore all of this.
Continue. Sorry. We're doing a demonstration underneath you.
Oh, okay. That's fine. We're having a conversation over in the chat about the cost of this to the enterprise support people. And yes, it absolutely is more expensive than ignoring it on the front end. My point is that you have to look at the cost of a breach. You have to look at the cost of a thoroughly compromised network. And I think more and more enterprise IT shops are figuring out that doing effective prevention on the front end is, in the long run, much more cost effective than trying to come up with an effective remediation program once some sort of massive intrusion has occurred.
Right. Underneath, Curtis, we were running a demonstration. If you go to grc.com/shieldsup, you can bypass all of the GRC opening menus items, and you can run your test on port 1900. Oliver, let me throw over to you on the last point on this story, and that is looking at all of the issues that are involved here. So you've got personal privacy, you've got security of the corporate network, corporate data set. You've got personal preference in your clients and how you set up your network. Where do you see this going in the next, say, 2 years? Because it's only going to get worse, and the biggest vector of infection of corporate networks is always going to be the users. Is it eventually going to reach a point in which it's going to be an office-issued piece of equipment? This is the only thing that you can use, only on this connection, only at these times. Where do you see the corporate restrictions coming down in order to secure their enterprise networks?
Wow. Again, you keep tossing the big ones at me.
Just because I love you.
Yeah, I know. For a specific threat like this, I mean, my initial reaction as an IT guy would be, well, screw it. We're not going to support outside equipment. I'm locking everything down. I don't care if they want to use their iPad or whatever. They're using what I tell them to, and I'm setting it up my way. That is becoming an untenable position going forward. So I have to think about what it would take for me to secure a user's firewall. And initially, again, the reaction is negative. But when you really think about it, I mean, a home firewall is a home firewall is a home firewall, really, as far as the interface, the management interface is concerned. So putting together a database of how to do it yourself or having my IT guys plug in and do it for them, really, it shouldn't be that big a headache. It just depends how many threats I'm going to be preventing in the future. And the biggest problem for me would be making sure that they're actually doing it, right? I would then need permission to scan those devices and make sure that my security provisions are being implemented. And if they're not, I get to cut the user off. So that is going to be dependent upon how their ISPs assign addresses and whether they allow me to do that, that kind of thing. So I think it's a pretty complicated question. I think in the end, it's going to have to be figured out on the IT staff side. And I think it's an inevitable headache. I think you're going to deal with it one way or another.
I like that. The inevitable headache, show title. I do want to take another break here to speak about another longtime sponsor, and that is RingCentral. Now, when Leo built the studio, he had a certain vision in mind. He wanted a place that looked forward into the technologies of the day and not into the past. And in the past is definitely the PBX. Now, you may have seen a PBX. It's those old clunky boxes that you hang on the wall and you snake cables all throughout the building. And probably in about 5 or 6 years, it becomes impossible to decipher because, well, you need to call in an engineer every time you want to change an extension or fix a problem. Leo didn't want that for the brick house. And so when Russell came up to him and said, hey, we could have all of this, but in the cloud, we had to jump. RingCentral gives us the ability to have a full-featured PBX without the PBX system. We love RingCentral. There are zero startup costs. There's no PBX hardware to install or maintain. RingCentral allows us to customize all of our call handling, Our producers get their voicemail and their email, and we can even get our fax messages right on our smartphones. Now, here's what RingCentral wants to do for you. They're offering you all-inclusive pricing, as low as $20 per month per user. You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial, and they have a special offer for my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. So call this number, designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. Once more, 800-543-9980, or you can go to ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com, promo code TWIT. And we thank RingCentral for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get to some of the meat of the episode. We've been talking a lot about privacy. We've been talking a lot about the government doing things or personal industries doing certain things, enterprise doing certain things. And so we thought we wanted to do a roundup of some of our favorite security tools, ways to keep our data secure. I'm going to start it off with, something that most of you have, even if you don't know it, and that is BitLocker. Now, BitLocker is a tool that is included in certain versions of Windows 7 and 8. You actually have to have the Pro or Ultimate, the Enterprise or Ultimate Edition for 7, or the Enterprise and Pro Edition of Windows 8. It can be used with the TPM. That's the Trusted Platform Module for Maximum Protection. The TPM is a little chip that's included within certain systems that allows you to associate certain, let's say, encryption profiles with specific pieces of hardware. So, for example, if you had a hard drive in a laptop that was tied to that TPM, someone couldn't pull the hard drive out of that laptop, plug it into a desktop, and pull the information off, because without that TPM, it would not be able to unlock the BitLocked encrypted hard drive. Now, you can use BitLocker for whole drive encryption, even if your computer doesn't have a TPM, but that will require the use of a USB startup key. So if you really did want to use BitLocker, you're going to want to get a computer that has TPM. It works on Windows 7 Enterprise and Ultimate, as well as Windows 8 Pro and Enterprise. It can be used on thumb drives, and it uses either 128 or 256-bit AES encryption. Chibert, have you played around with BitLocker at all, either for whole drive encryption or encryption of USB drives?
Yeah, TPM is one of those weird things that a lot of machines, it's off by default. So one of the things you are going to have to do is turn it on and go through the setup, meaning you're going to have to put some passwords and things like that on it. But once you have TPM set up, BitLocker actually works really well. It takes a little while the first time because it's got an encrypted area, but it just bloody works.
Yeah, just bloody works. Now, this is one of those almost the best kept secret in enterprise security. Curtis, I'm going to throw over to you. There's a lot of people who don't realize that this is actually baked into many versions of Windows, right? I mean, BitLocker is something maybe they've heard of, but I rarely see enabled on laptops and enterprise data systems.
Yeah, I think many enterprise IT groups are a little bit reluctant to enable BitLocker because they fear that they will end up with data that they don't have access to. I think we're seeing a lot of enterprises that do use a system similar to this to do whole disk encryption, but they tend to like it to be very centrally managed. And many of them don't realize that BitLocker itself can be centrally managed. This is one where I think the adoption curve has been slow, but the more I talk to IT people, I think the awareness is beginning slowly to grow on it.
Oliver, actually, I want to cut over to you really quickly because I know that you have a hard out here. I wanted you to get your tool in. You wanted to talk about Surf Easy. What is that?
Actually, I got a little point to make on BitLocker first.
Okay, do that, and then let's go to Surf Easy.
Yeah, okay, real quick. Yes, where I just worked, a certain evil empire up in Seattle, BitLocker was mandatory, and it is centrally managed. And yes, any computer you buy for yourself and want to use on a corporate basis must have a TPM in it. All the images that are downloadable for those, it immediately make use of it and do whole drive encryption. And it doesn't really help them because every user then starts downloading data for whatever reason onto a USB key. They lose the USB key. The USB key is not BitLockered, and the data gets out anyway. So if you're going to use it, You have to make sure that your policy extends to storage devices outside the laptop. Otherwise, BitLocker really isn't going to help you from an enterprise perspective.
Right.
Right.
That's actually something I've heard on the wish list from IT admins, and that is when you make that decision to BitLocker the laptop hard drive or the desktop hard drive or the server hard drive, they want an extensible policy that could say, and do not allow the user to copy files from a BitLocker drive to a non-BitLocker drive. You know, if Redmond would make that easy, then yeah, maybe we could have that whole security sense of touchy-feely security. But yeah, continue.
Yeah. So SurfEasy, I actually got this off of Twit. You guys did an interview with this guy at CES where this product was introduced, and I went out and I got it as soon as it shipped, and it's been working great. Since I don't work for the Evil Empire anymore, I work for a lot of contractors, so I'm going from office to office to office, and I'm using, for whatever reason, their PCs a whole lot instead of just my laptop, which I hate, but there it is. So what you do with this little guy is it's just a USB plug. You stick it into the computer, and you have a completely secure browsing session. It uses their browser, and it wipes your whole digital fingerprint off the PC when you leave, and it automatically encrypts everything you're doing. So I was getting worried. I'm horrible with bills. I like to pay my bills wherever I am. I worry about that if I'm on a computer. I don't know. You plug that guy in, and you don't have to worry about it. If you're at an airport, I haven't had to do this, but if you're at an airport, you got to change your travel res, right? You have to use a credit card number. Pow, I always worry about that, right? This guy, you plug that in, it's taken care of for you. So I'm not as geeky as the guy from Hawaii with the food stain on his face. But and for that reason, I like having things just set up for me. And that's, I think, the real value of this little product. I think you can do everything it does on your own if you want to. I'm just lazy. So for the $60 that this costs, I'm very happy with it.
I like that. So you have a sort of a self-contained operating system to go on a USB key, and no matter what computer you plug it into, you're getting back into that self-contained image.
Well, it's not an OS. It's just the browser.
Just the browser.
It's based on Mozilla. It looks very similar. So far, I haven't encountered any problems with playing content. So I like it.
Chibert, compare this to, say, Windows 8 to Go. What would be the difference between having this, a browser on a stick, and having a self-contained Windows 8 operating system on a stick?
If all you need is a browser, that sounds significantly easier. Because keep in mind, Windows to Go, you're booting a complete operating system, complete environment. It's completely separate. So if you need to run your own special apps, Windows Go might not be a bad idea. Keeping in mind that when Kingston ships these, so the Kingston flavor, it's shipped with Windows 8 in demo mode. So it's up to you to go and get an activation key from your IT group or buy an activation key. It's a good system. I like it. You can BitLocker the Windows to Go drive. It's a nice solution, but it's killing an ant with a sledgehammer if all you need is a browser.
Right. Curtis, what about that? Would you prefer that your employees used a sledgehammer or used a mobile browser?
Well, I think that if all of your apps are browser-based, then the mobile browser works just fine. Because it does offer the ability to be A, much easier to set up and configure, and B, you can use it on multiple systems. I really think it's the question of how you've got your application set up. If you have traditional client server sorts of apps, then you're going to need to come in with something like the whole disk encryption, or Windows to Go. BitLocker makes sense. The tough thing is that we really can't look at these just in a vacuum. When you start asking questions like this, you have to look at your entire enterprise IT infrastructure and figure out a solution that works within the context of that overall architecture.
Right. Oliver, you do have to leave us, don't you?
Not till 2, dude.
Oh, Oh, okay, 2 o'clock. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said 1 o'clock. Never mind. Well, yeah, then
kicked me off early. What the hell?
In that case, I really shouldn't have given you deferential treatment. I wanted to stay with BitLocker for a while.
Always give me deferential treatment.
Okay, my bad, my bad. All right, so we've got two tools so far. We've got BitLocker, which is built into Windows, which allows you to encrypt whole drives, USB drives, which does have a couple of, a need for some extensible security markup. And we've got Oliver's browser on a stick. Cheebert, let me go over to you because your product is a little different. Whereas Oliver's offering you a way to have sort of your session saved on a portable device, and I'm offering a way to encrypt data, yours is focused on protecting passwords.
Right. I have to work on lots and lots and lots of different systems. I think I'm up to like 2,800, maybe close to 3,000 different passwords that are supposed to remember. Fat chance. out of self-defense, I needed something that was on my laptop, on my phone, and on my tablets. So I went with Splash ID Key. It's actually a combination of products that are available for Windows Mobile, CrackBerry, iOS, Android, Mac OS X, Windows, you name it. It's all over the place. In fact, if we could switch back. Oops. Go back. No, I'm done. This is, this is hard to see. So this is the iPad version. And here's my Windows Mobile 7.5. This is Mango on a Lumia 710. And what I do is, as long as my laptop and my portable device is on the same Wi-Fi network, I can actually sync it back and forth. I also have a USB key that has the portable database, and it actually can run from the USB key. So if I need to get access to my passwords and I'm on someone else's machine, the USB key leaves a zero footprint. The other nice thing about it is all the databases are encrypted with AES 256 encryption. And if you manage to blow your password X number of times, it will actually do a military wipe on the database. And for those of you that say, oh, that means you can't back it up. No, you can back it up. You can actually back up an encrypted image to whatever you want. And it could be a USB key, could be a standard file. I actually back it up to a lot of different places. But it is an encrypted database. And as long as I have the password, I don't lose the master password, I can bring my database back, even if my laptop has been stolen.
Right. You know, what I like about this solution is, as we see up on the screen right now, we've all got numbers and passwords and usernames that we need to remember. It could be everything from PINs to credit card numbers to Social Security to, really long strings of characters. A product like this pretty much guarantees that I'm always going to have access to a list that otherwise may remain safe. It's relatively secure from getting hacked. It's relatively secure from accidentally being left open. It's not, let's say, a Word document protected by a password that contains everything that I have in my digital life. So it's something that can complement any other data security process that you may undertake. Curtis, what do you think about this? I mean, a password manager, a secure data vault, seems like something that its time has come in the enterprise, yes?
You know, I really think it is, and a lot of people use these. Now, I will admit, I don't. I have my own password schemas that I use, and there's no real good reason, just it's what works for me. I have family members who use products like this who are thrilled. I know enterprises that require them, whether they are internal or cloud-based services like this. And they really do make a lot of sense because they get past something that I know is a huge problem. I remember my dad, while he was still alive, was working for a defense contractor, and he had to use a long, very strong password that rolled over twice a month, and he couldn't use the same password for any of the half dozen different applications they had. Dad was in his 70s, and trying to remember all the passwords was a major task. For most of us, memory is a limiting function, and something like this can make a huge difference in making sure that our passwords are secure.
Oliver, I want to pose an interesting question to you again, and that is, it used to be that we always told people, well, never have the same password for two different sites or two different services, and this predates the internet. I mean, this is back to the days of the BBS and ATM PIN codes. But then there was also a train of thought, well, if I have to write things down, then I've just negated the added security of having different passwords. It seems to me that we're getting back to the idea of I can have a single device, be it my smartphone, my tablet, or my laptop, that actually does have all of my secure information, all my personally identifying information, and I protect that with a single password. But now I'm back to having a single password. I mean, it may not be the same password for all the different services, but it's a single password that grants me access to everything. Are we going forward in security, backward in security? What does an application like this, like Splash ID, do for us in terms of security?
Mm-hmm. Me personally, I don't have nearly as many passwords as Brian seems to. So I've developed a system that relates to whatever resource I'm trying to plug into that only I know. It's a little code that will generate the password for me. Each password is follows that particular code for each site, so that lets me remember it, and it's still strong. If I had 2,800 passwords to remember, then pretty much, in my opinion, this is the only solution, and you're going to go back to a single password for your database, which is that pro or con security? I think it's almost an irrelevant question. I think it's a mandatory thing you're going to have to deal with, right? As more passwords are required, you're going to have something like this. And if you're saying there's going to be, a single one across different resources, I don't see that happening.
As CR1 in the chat room has said, a little waterboarding and those passwords just appear as if by magic. And I think a lot of the discussion, the theoretical discussion about one password, multiple passwords, sort of glosses over the whole idea that, look, we are the ones that are going to store all these passwords, and we're ultimately the weakest link to any security protection system. But let's move on. I want to get over to Curtis. Curtis, you have a choice called, I don't even know how to pronounce it. Is it Cloudonymous? Cloudonymous?
Cloudonymous.
Cloudonymous. Okay, so what is Cloudonymous?
Well, Cloudonymous is one of those things, I do computing from a lot of different places. Now, I do have a VPN set up back to my office system where I can do secure browsing. But if for some reason I'm having trouble with this allows me to have an encrypted and an anonymous connection to the internet. It has some other features. It is a pay service, but it does allow for VPNs, and it has some other features. I mean, personally, I'm pleased that they have a VPN connection in Great Britain, because that allows me to get to BBC programming pretty easily. But that's entirely apart from its enterprise functions. Something like this, a commercial VPN package is the important thing. Some companies have VPNs that they want you to be able to connect to, but there are other times when just having a secure connection, whether or not it's going straight back to the enterprise, is important. For those situations, something like Cloudonymous can be a great solution.
Chibert, what about that? Because proxy VPNs, yes, they are security, but also they're anti-security. Yes, they are, right? Because, I mean, if I allow users to look as if they're coming from different places in the world that they're not actually coming from, there is an element of black hattery to that, or at least there can be.
Well, I don't know. a lot of this is policy. When you start getting friends like Comcast and so forth that are blocking all kinds of ports, a lot of people are forced to set up proxies all over the world. And, goofy little things like the Olympics. BBC was doing a great feed, but only if you had an IP address from the UK. Well, very quickly, hundreds of proxy servers got set up in the UK so that people could watch even if they weren't in the UK. I personally was going to go to the Olympics until I found out how much it was going to cost. I mean, $1,000 a head for the opening ceremonies? Bite me.
That's another show title. Bite me. Okay. Oliver, let me go over to you because I'm sure you're not going to have any sort of cynical or sort of cranky way of looking at this.
Never.
Never, never. What is your take on these VPN, proxy location services?
My take on VPN proxy location services. That's a nice little, you should write that down. I don't like them. Anything that disguises where someone is coming. I mean, as far as security goes, honesty is the best policy. As far as monitoring things, anything that's disguising anything else, or I just think that's going to lead to long-term confusion, right? Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon for the rest of your life.
I can always count on you, Oliver. And that's what I was trying to get at, which is, you know, it's for the geek community, something like this seems cool. It sounds cool. You know, of course, I should have the ability to bounce my signal off of anywhere I want it to be. So if let's say I'm in Europe and I want to access Netflix in the United States, the ability to actually have some sort of VPN proxy service lets me look like I'm coming from the United States and therefore access the service that I've already paid for. Now, that's one gray area usage, but we can all imagine some really black area usages of this. We already know that there are attacks coming from different parts of the world. If we're now offering services that defeat one of the very basic levels of security detection, of forensic networking, and that is to look at IP addresses, to look at where requests are coming from, where packets are coming from, then yeah, I think this is something that becomes very problematic in the future. Curtis, let me throw this back over to you because, I mean, this is your service. I mean, it definitely has good uses, but does that overcome everything ill that this can be used for?
Well, again, I think that I believe it was Brian who said that it gets back to the issues of policy within your network, policies within your enterprise. A strong case can be made for not using something like this within the policy. I'll get back to what I said the last time we were talking on this subject. It all has to do with your overall enterprise architecture and how you're protecting it. If you don't need this, if you don't want it, it should be easy to create policies against it. If you have a policy that says that in particular times and locations, this might be the only way to have a secure connection, then it can become an option. And it may well be, pardon me, that your enterprise wants to create a relationship with particular providers so that there is a greater sense of knowledge and security between the two. All kinds of solutions along a spectrum to say that one type of solution never has a role within the enterprise is, I think, a little bit more restrictive than we need to go. But to say that you need to look at your overall architecture, your overall security posture, that's really where we need to be going with all this.
Fantastic. All right, I want to move to one last tool before we exit out, and that is TrueCrypt. Now, I've got it installed on my laptop here. I bring this up because it is popular in the chat realm. It's very popular among geeks who have been encrypting their stuff for a long time. It's a very simple, lightweight client that allows you to create volumes, either hidden or real virtual volumes. Here, I'm going to start one from scratch. I'm going to create a volume in V. I'm going to select the device, which is going to be this this Kingston flash drive I have. So this is a removable, encryptable device. And I'm going to create a volume. And then I get to choose what kind of container and how I want it to look. So I'm going to say I need a non-system partition drive. I want the entire thing. Oh, don't look at my password. And then I'm going to either create a standard TrueCrypt volume or a hidden TrueCrypt volume. If I wanted to create a cache of data that I didn't want people to be able to know was even there, I would create a hidden. But in this case, I'm going to create a standard volume and put it here. And I should be good to go. And boom. And then I get to choose the kind of security. In this case, I'm going to use AES. I get to use the hash, in which case I'm going to use 160, and then I choose a password for it. And again, you don't get to see it. Yeah. No. And there we go. So what it's doing right now is it's preparing this little flash drive, this little 8 gigabyte flash drive. It's going to make it so that anytime I want to access that flash drive, it's going to make me enter in my password. It's going to make me access it through my TrueCrypt software. Now, the cool thing about this is I don't need a TPM. So I don't need a trusted platform module. It uses pipelining and parallelization, which means on a fast computer, something like this S7 with an i7 CPU, it should be more or less real time. It will parallelize the encryption and decryption so that it's not really slowing down what I'm doing along with accessing the drive. It can also create, as I mentioned, hidden volumes, which is really, really useful if you have data that you don't even want them to know that you're using encryption. The downside to that is you need to be using a large enough drive, like let's say a 16 gigabyte flash drive that you format for 8 gigabytes so that they can actually see that there's some actual data on the drive. It's kind of like creating a camouflage. It can also use the SHA-512 hash algorithm, so you can really bump up the level of encryption, the level of security that you're using. The thing that I don't like about this is that preparing drives, like, for example, if Jason were to switch back to my screen here, this is a relatively small drive on a relatively fast bus. I'm only at 4% right now, so you really do need to pre-prepare your drives, especially if you're going to be, say, encrypting a 1 terabyte, 2 terabyte, 3 terabyte drive. Very cool program, very useful program, especially since I can encrypt into a virtual image and then upload that image into, say, Mega or Dropbox or whatever cloud storage service that I might be using. It's a nice way to add a level of security on top of a commercially available service. As Steve Gibson would say, it's trust no one. Chibert, have you ever used TrueCrypt in your lab?
No, actually, I haven't. I was actually just on their website and thinking, wow, this looks pretty good, especially since it supports Mac OS X.
Right. It supports Macs. It supports Linux. It's really, really lightweight. And for all the Uber geeks out there, it's open source. It's completely open source, which means you can get in and you can root around and you can see exactly what it's doing if you're one of these people who's always concerned that there might be some sort of weakness to the algorithm or even a backdoor installed. Now, because it is open source, it also means that Enterprise may be a little shy to adopt it. Is my read on that right, Curtis?
I think it's absolutely right. I don't think there's any question that this is the sort of thing that enterprises are going to be taking a close look at. You know, it's fascinating when we have new things, when we have things that deal with the security realm. We can find companies that have been very forward-thinking suddenly become very conservative, and I think this is one of those areas.
Yeah. And Oliver, what about you? I mean, when I look at something like TrueCrypt, which is a off-the-shelf, available on the internet, very small encryption software, what makes it not usable in an enterprise environment?
To me, I mean, if it's enterprise, 90% of those guys have to deal with some kind of security regulatory compliance, right? So,
right.
I don't know if TrueCrypt how accepted TrueCrypt is in those circles. My suspicion is, since it's open source, probably not many, and which will kill it instantly for those businesses.
Right, right. But again, it's just another option. So I presented two different encryption softwares. One is BitLocker, which definitely does meet those requirements, which definitely does play well with enterprise. The other is TrueCrypt, and I just offered because anyone who is watching this episode later on is inevitably going to ask me why I didn't include the open source option. Last chance for the panel to comment on any of the tools that we brought up for security in this episode.
Well, I think one of the comments I need to remind people on is that for BitLocker, if you're migrating a machine, decrypt the hidden volume.
Okay.
Recrypt it on the new machine because the keys in the TPM chip are in the TPM chip.
Yes, absolutely. Good advice. Oliver, Curtis, last chance.
Actually, that's great advice. That's how I lost a PC once. Like it just died. It became a paperweight.
Yeah, I agree. TPM chips, while they're truly and completely wonderful, even Dell and Intel and a lot of other people say, if you lose your password, you have just created a brick for the entire machine. You can't even put another hard drive into it and revive that laptop.
Did that.
It's not a bug. It's a feature.
Yeah, it's exactly.
Now, speaking of features, I want to thank my panel very much for coming in. This has been a long episode. It's been a very informational episode. But, of course, I want to give them a chance to plug the things that they are doing, the things that they want to expose to our audience. Let's start with you, Chibert. What's going on in Hawaii and what's going on with ThinLinks?
Well, I have a Windows 8 machine on an i5 set up, and I'm playing with client Hyper-V. I've also got an i7-based machine that's multi-boot. I've got multi-point server. I've got server 2012 and server 2008 R2 SP1. And the whole idea is to make a test environment because we're doing final testing on the ThinLinks Hottie, a.k.a. the TLX1000 and eventually the TLX2000. We've already had some listeners in the UK saying, when can we buy these? And the answer is, right now, we're just shipping out review units, and hopefully within about 2 to 3 months, we will have the full production ramped up so we can start fulfilling quantity orders.
And, of course, we're going to see it here on This Week in Enterprise Tech.
You bet.
Okay. What about you, Curtis? What's going on with enterprise efficiency? What do you have coming up? What do our listeners need to know about?
Well, we have a variety of different radio shows coming up tomorrow, as a matter of fact. I've got a radio show at 1 o'clock Eastern Time with the VP of Technology of the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association. This is going to be a great show. We've got a bunch of stuff coming up, so we'd love it if people would check out and join us over there. We're also going into the spring conference and trade show season. I'm going to be at a bunch of different shows, a bunch of different conferences, ranging from Sapphire now to Interop. So let me know where you're going to be. I'd love to have a face-to-face meeting with members of the TWIET community while we're out there.
You heard it here. We're going to have a TWIET up with Curtis Franklin. Now, going from the cowboy rodeo to the network rodeo, we've got our very own cowboy. And Oliver, what's going on with you?
Actually, I've just joined the Cowboy Rodeo Association. I finally finished my Windows Server Essentials review. Should be going up pretty soon. Thankfully, it's an overtime review, not just a basic one. So I've been using it here. I'm back to hardware servers. Look for some more hardware server reviews. However, I'm based on this conversation on these shows, I'm going to try to pitch me a new firewall review, and I'd like to do it at Brian's lab. So if anybody in the TWI community would like to email InfoWorld and really ask for that, saying it should happen in Honolulu and Oliver should be shipped there forthwith, I would appreciate that.
Actually, let me go one further. Oliver, what is the InfoWorld Twitter address? Do you happen to know off the top of your head?
The InfoWorld, it's probably hashtag InfoWorld, but no, I don't know it off the top
okay,
of my head.
Okay, chat realm, this is what I want you to do. Or actually, anyone listening to this. As soon as this show is done, I want you to find out whatever their tag is, whatever their username is. I want you to tweet out to them that we need Oliver in Honolulu to give us the goods. Just make that the hashtag, give us the goods. We'll do that just for you. All right. As always, I want to thank everyone here who has made this possible. Our super TD, Jason, who has been languishing behind the desk, wondering what the heck we're talking about. We've got Carson, who is sick right now with kids, which means necessarily he is sick because kids are bags of germs that live in your house. Also, Beatmaster in studio, he has been providing all of the in-house comedy. It's been a nonstop routine over here. It's been fantastic. And as always, you're welcome to come and check out the TWIET Brickhouse goodness. Also, did you know that we do this show live? That's right, every Monday. If you're not watching it right now, it means you're listening to it. And if you're listening to it, then why the heck are you doing that when you could watch us go at it? In fact, if you drop by at noon Pacific time, that live.twit.tv every Monday at noon, you can also jump into the chat room at irc.twit.tv and meet people like Beatmaster, meet people like CR1, meet people like Trey, the most brilliant engineers, the funniest trolls. It's an experiment in community. Also, you can download our program in multiple formats, pretty much anything that you need. If you want the audio version for your drive to or from work, great, you can get that. If you want a large, high-definition version for cuddling up with a loved one in front of your plasma screen TV, we got that. iPod, iPad, Zune, Android device, all of these are options for you to get This Week in Enterprise Tech delivered to your devices each and every single week. Also, did you know that we have a brand spanking new YouTube page? That's right. If you go to youtube.com/Twiat, you can get all of our new episodes, and hopefully you'll be able to hear an announcement soon about our very, very first hangout. That's right. The Digital Jesuit, maybe Chibert, possibly even Oliver and Curtis will be hanging out at one Friday at some point in the very near future to answer questions about enterprise networking or just about how things are going in the digital world. Finally, you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/PadreSJ. You'll be able to ask me questions about the episodes or suggest topics for future episodes or just find out what's going on in the world of the Digital Jesuit. I want to thank you all for coming for This Week in Enterprise Tech. And remember, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.